This Do Lectures episode features cyclist and author Rob Penn, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2011.
Thanks very much. I'd just like it to be known for the record that I was not kidnapped walking past the sauna by naked pixies last night, even though I did walk past it 5 times. I just like, minus the clicker, there we are. Is that way? Other way? There we go. Brilliant, we're off. I'm very flattered to be here. I'm a journalist and author, occasional TV presenter. I've been a photographer, a DJ, a pot washer, a builder, and the continuity in all those things for me has been the bicycle. I've ridden the bicycle for 37 years. I've ridden one most days of my adult life. And in my late 20s, I gave up a career as a lawyer in London and rode a bicycle around the world. And at the end of that journey, I did a lot of public speaking in circumstances not entirely dissimilar to this. And on one occasion, I spoke to a room full of retired naval officers in the Meon Valley in Hampshire. And at the end of the talk, I said, are there any questions? And there was this soft sea of silence, broken only by the gentle snores of senior men. And eventually a hand went up at the back, very erect, man with silver slick back hair, military tie, very, very smart blazer. And he said, ah, Mr. Penn, it's all very interesting hearing your stories about Iran and Chinese Turkestan, but would you like to tell us a little something about some of the hookers you slept with on your journey? Which made me realise that people come to these sorts of things for very different reasons. And fortunately, there is time to ask some questions at the end, so I hope you'll have some, and you can direct the information to that which that aspect of the bicycle which animates you most. Today, I ride a bike to get to work, sometimes for work. I ride a bike to bathe in air and sunshine. I ride a bike to go shopping. I ride a bike to stay sane. I ride a bike to escape when the world is breaking my balls. I ride a bike to savour the physical and emotional fellowship of riding with friends. I ride for a moment of grace. I ride to skip bath time with my kids. I ride for fun. I ride to hear my boy laugh. It's a broad church of physical, practical and emotional reasons unified by one thing. No other mode of transportation comes even close to representing that kind of breadth. So riding a bicycle is fundamental to my being, and why not? It's the most efficient means of self-powered transportation we have yet devised. It's the most popular form of transport on the planet. It has been for over a century. I own 7 bikes. I don't need 7 bikes. I really don't need 7 bikes. I only need one, but I couldn't live without one, and so 2 years ago, I embarked on a journey to acquire the one. And I went around the world going to component manufacturers to put together my dream bike. There it is. And I'm going to click through the slide. Sorry, I missed that one. That's me on my way around the world on the bicycle. So what did I want? I wanted the bike, the one. I wanted a talismanic bike, a bike that somehow reflected my devotion to the machine. I wanted craftsmanship, not technology. I wanted the bike to be man-made in as much as that is possible these days. I wanted a bike that had character, a bike that would never be last year's model. I wanted to savour the process of acquiring this bike because I'm not going to replace it. I wanted a bike that showed my appreciation of the tradition, law and beauty of bicycles. I wanted the bike I'm going to grow old with, the bike I'm going to ride for the rest of my life. Now, before you all start to think that we're heading off into the illicit realms of hardcore bike pornography, let me assure you that we're not. I'm not going to take you there. Anyone wants to meet me outside the tent later? Don't worry, we can do it there. But here we're not going to go into hardcore bike pornography. What is fundamental, though, about the journey that I made to put this bike together has resonance way beyond the world of two wheels. I wasn't looking for the lightest, the sexiest, the cheapest, the most expensive, the trendiest components, the greatest trophy components. I was simply looking for the best made. I was looking for artisans, people who have more in common with the craftsmen who make Patek Philippe watches or Monteleone guitars or Pirelli shirts than with the mass manufacturers who turn out carbon and aluminium frames in the Far East. Not long ago, much of what we owned was alive with the skill and even the idealism of the people who made it. The blacksmith who forged our tools, the cobbler, the wood turner, the carpenter, the wheelwright, the seamstress, the tailor who made our clothes. And we retain possessions that are well made. And over time, they grow in value to us and they enrich our lives when we use them. And we seem to have forgotten this as a society. In a very, very short period of time, we live in a dystopian age where almost everything we own begins to deteriorate the moment it comes out of the box. Tout passe, tout casse, tout lasse, as the French say. Everything changes, everything breaks, everything wears out. Buy it, use it, bury it in the ground. And for me, the start point of this bicycle was a positive move to try and break that cycle. Now, in the time I have, I'm not going to go through the components of the bike because there really isn't time. But just very briefly, the saddle is made by Brooks. It's made to a design which was patented in 1896, went into production in 1896. It is unchanged since then. The wheels comprise DT Swiss rims, Sapim spokes from Belgium, and hubs made by a wonderful craftsman engineer in Hampshire called Cliff Poulton. And the wheels were handmade by a guy called Steve Gravenites in Marin County in California. The handlebar and the stem come from Cinelli, the factory in Milan, northern Italy, and the drivetrain is from Campagnolo, again, Vicenza, in northern Italy. And the frame, I just must give a special mention to because it is the diamond soul of the machine. And the frame was made to measure, like a bespoke suit, by an artisan frame builder called Jason Rourke in Stoke-on-Trent, and it's made from British steel. I spent a lot of time with Jason, getting measured for the frame, watching it being welded, and then obviously painted and the bike being built up. And one of the very lovely things about being in a frame builder's workshop is all of the bare frames. And there is a simple grace about an unadorned bicycle frame. And on one of the occasions when I was there, looking at this sort of row of bare frames hanging from the ceiling, all waiting to be built up into bikes, something struck me. They were all made from different types of tubing. They were painted to individual specifications. They had different dimensions and angles. And they would be built into different types of bike and ridden in very different ways over diverse terrain by diverse humans. But they were all, in one fundamental way, alike. The frames were all the same shape. Diamond, two triangles. John Kemp Starley is, I suspect, the greatest British inventor you've never heard of. Maybe some of you have, and I do hope so. But if you haven't, he gave the world the diamond-shaped frame in 1885. He probably didn't invent it. These ideas as important as this, are in the ether in several different places simultaneously. But he certainly popularised it, and he popularised it with the Rover safety bicycle. which changed the way we ride forever. By 1890, every maker worthy of the name was producing a safety model. What directly preceded it was the penny farthing, or the ordinary, which was a patently unsafe to ride, a huge front wheel, very, very small back wheel. It was nicknamed the Widowmaker. When you came off one, it hurt. And the safety bicycle was so cool because the wheel's the same size as a drivetrain which connects the pedals to the rear wheel and you can touch the ground with both feet, the safety. Starley himself died suddenly in 1901, aged 46. Every cycle firm in Coventry closed their works on the day of his funeral, which was attended by 20,000 people. Perhaps the mourners had the prescience to know that the Rover safety was a transport phenomenon, and that the basic shape of the bicycle would remain unchanged for the whole of the 20th century. And if you contrast this with, say, the Wright Flyer, The world's first powered aircraft, built by Wilbur and Orville Wright, who are bike mechanics, incidentally. And compare that with Concorde. Or you take Carl Benz's four-stroke gasoline engine, also invented in 1885, and compare that with a Formula One racing car. In both these modes of transportation, the vehicles have changed almost continuously. With the Rover Safety, the modern bicycle arrived virtually perfectly formed. There have been hundreds, perhaps thousands, of attempts to better the diamond frame design in the century and a quarter since it set the fashion to the world, and none could be said to have got close. Racing, mountain, touring, hybrid, track, utility, cruiser, fixed wheel, dirt jumper, porter, BMX, every type of bicycle is constructed with a diamond frame. Today, the global fleet numbers, well, we don't really know, somewhere between 1.5 and 2 billion bicycles being ridden around the world at the moment. Nearly every single one is built with a diamond-shaped frame. You can spend £10 on a rusting roadster at a jumble sale. You can spend £75,000 on a 24-carat gold-plated bicycle encrusted with Swarovski crystals. It's true, I've seen it, and it was patently the most grotesque thing I've ever seen in my life. Either way, you will get a diamond-shaped frame. I'm just going to pour myself a glass of water. So constancy in the shape of the bicycle over the last century and a quarter explains a lot about where we're at with the machine. It goes some way to explaining why one riding one is so elementary, why we start so young, why we ride one so young. It relates to why we reference the bicycle as the one motor skill once learnt, never forgotten. It's like riding a bike. It partly explains why the machine seems to sync with the human software so well. It's also why there is a sense of classical moderation in the kind of pleasure a bicycle ride affords. Nothing compares to the simple pleasure of a bike ride, as President John F. Kennedy said. I always thought it was a bit of a put-down for Marilyn Monroe, but there you go. As the late Sheldon Brown, the great writer and esteemed bike mechanic, wrote, the diamond frame is one of the most perfect pieces of design known due to its purity of form. Starley's safety bicycle was the culmination of a long and elusive quest for a human-powered vehicle. And when the pneumatic tyre was added to it, invention of John Lloyd Dunlop, 3 years later, the machine became comfortable, and this initiated the first great golden age of the bicycle. As Victor Hugo wrote, an invasion of armies can be resisted, but not an idea whose time has come. In 1890, there were an estimated 150,000 cyclists in the USA. A bicycle cost 6 months' wages for a factory worker. By 1895, a bike cost a couple of weeks' wages, and there were 1 million new cyclists every year. By the end of the 1890s, which was a remarkable decade in so many ways, not just for the development of the bicycle. By the end of the 1890s, the bicycle had become a utilitarian form of transport for millions. It was known as the people's nag. For the first time in history, the working class were mobile, as they could now commute, crowded tenements emptied, suburbs were created, and the geography of cities changed. In the British countryside, the bicycle helped redistribute and shore up the gene pool. And this is an extraordinary thing, but it's widely acknowledged now. And it's for the very simple reason that people could go that little bit further for a bit of How's Your Father? And you see from British place names, studies of British place names, the 1890s was the first time when surnames began to appear far away from the rural locality with which they've been fiercely associated from medieval times. Everywhere, the bicycle was a catalyst for campaigns to improve roads, literally paving the way for the motor car. And perhaps the greatest impact that the bicycle had was in breaking down hitherto rigid gender and class barriers. There was a democracy to the bicycle that society was powerless to resist. As the novelist John Galsworthy wrote, the bicycle has been responsible for more movement in manners and morals than anything since Charles II. The bicycle was also a pivotal battleground in the long war for women's suffrage. Cycling became the first popular athletic pursuit for women, and it was a turning point in the acceptance of practical clothes. This is Annie Londonderry. In 1894, she set off from Boston with some spare clothes and a pearl-handled revolver to cycle around the world. Witty, clever, charismatic, something of a Becky Sharp for her age, she self-consciously took up the mantle of women's equality. And she was a paragon of what was then known as New Woman, an American term for the modern woman who behaved outrageously like the equal of men. The bicycle, dubbed the Freedom Machine by historian Robert Smith, mandated New Woman. By the time Butch and Sundance were bound for South America, the bicycle had won broad social acceptance and struck deep into the nexus of society. In a decade, cycling had evolved from a faddish leisure pursuit, as it very much was when it was the penny farthing or the high wheeler, and it was exclusive to a tiny minority of wealthy athletic males. And it had become the most popular form of transport on the planet. The bicycle is, to my mind, one of mankind's greatest inventions. It's up there with the printing press, the electric motor, the telephone, penicillin, the World Wide Web. Our ancestors thought it one of their greatest achievements. And this idea is now coming back into vogue. That I'm here talking about this simple machine is indicative of this. 20 years ago, it was deeply unfashionable. And the cultural status of the bicycle has gone through an extraordinary turnaround in that period of time. The machine is becoming embedded in Western society again through urban infrastructure design, transport policy, leisure practices. In fact, there is a whisper that we might today be at the dawn of a new golden age of the bicycle. And everything I saw on the journey I made to build my dream bike suggested that this is not mere hyperbole. Health concerns, transport issues, the environment, the price of oil, these things are driving the bicycle back to the centre of public consciousness again. In Britain, the hegemony are riding bicycles in a way that they haven't since the 1890s. Media commentators, political leaders, leading businessmen, pop stars, fashion gurus, models are all riding and advocating bicycles, as are you, in a way that would have been unthinkable 20 years ago. When I first started commuting in London 20 years ago, I used to ride through Hyde Park, and I knew the Christian name of every single commuter. That's how few there were of us. There was a sense of anarchy on the streets. To ride a bicycle was almost an act of civil disobedience in a way. And I used to use one particular bike shop in central London, in Holborn. And it was where the couriers used to hang out. And I took my mountain bike in there once because I'd broken the crank. And I went in on Friday night, that's when I was working as a lawyer, in my sort of pinstripe suit, to pick the bike up. And there were sort of three, you know, chiseled, heroin chic couriers at the end of the shop sharing a can of special brew. And the guy wheeled my bike out, and there was the old crank, the severed crank, which he'd taken off, a great big lump of aluminium, taped to the handlebar of my bike. And as I was paying him, I sort of looked at it and looked at him, and he looked at the couriers, and I said, what's that for? And then there was a long pause, and again, he looked at me, and I looked at him, and he looked at the couriers, and the couriers looked at him. And then eventually one of the couriers looked at me and went, you stick it through the windscreen of a fucking car. Okay. Great, great. Thanks. Nice and handy for me, so I can... Brilliant. And I moved to Wales 8 years ago, back to Wales 8 years ago, and I had another lesson in the changing public consciousness of the bicycle. And so I used to ride up and down the lanes every day from my home to my wee office in Abergavenny. And the farmers, the local farmers, regarded me with great suspicion. as I went past every day on my bicycle. And after I'd been there 6 months, I was up in my local pub on a wild night in November, on a Friday night, and one of the local farmers, who I didn't even know his name, I just knew where he lived, and he came over and he sort of cut my elbow and he led me discreetly to a corner of the pub. And he looked at me and he said, I seen you on the bike, boy. So how long you lost your license for then? And I sort of thought, well, I could try and explain that I actually just love riding a bicycle, but what if, no, forget it. The world's first ever cycling magazine, Le Velocipede Illustré, concluded in an editorial in 1869, the steel horse fills a gap in modern life. It is an answer not only to its needs, but also to its aspirations. It's quite certainly here to stay. The same thing could be written today. 20 years from now, many cities in the developed world will have successfully reintegrated the bicycle into their infrastructure. And I'm sure that our cities will look and feel very, very different in a quarter of a century. And so that's your do. Keep riding bicycles. It's as simple as that. What could be more pleasurable? As H.G. Wells said, when I see an adult on a bicycle, I do not despair for the future of the human race. He would have been full of hope today, as am I. As they used to say at the BBC, if you have been listening, thanks very much.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.